You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Welcome. In these podcasts, we explore a huge range of crucial issues and exciting developments in the food industry with brilliant guests drawn from all areas of expertise. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a TV presenter and writer, and I specialize in food and science. Today's podcast is one of our Investor Watch series, and this first one for 2021 is all about food tech. I want to know what 2021 looks like for the investors looking to part with their money to help shape the future of our food system. Now, it's obviously been an unusual year up until now, but as we know from our podcast back in September, COVID-19 has not put investment on hold. And in fact, in some senses, it's helped increase investment, especially investment aimed at helping us adapt to future challenges. Now, to discuss all of this, we have Paul Rouse, a director of the Open Data Exchange and co-founder of the Shape Climate Change Investment Program. Hello, Paul.
Hi, Stefan. Thank you very much. Good to be here.
And Roger Peterson, Managing Director of PIMWIMIC. Hello there, Roger.
Hey, Stefan, how are you?
Very good. Now, Paul and Roger joined us at our Food Tech Matters event back in October 2020. Food Tech Matters is back again this year on the 20 to 21st of April with a brand new format that goes even further to connect innovative startups with the investment community through a series of fast-paced pitches and one-to-one meetings across 2 days. Now, let's dive into this. Paul, let's start with you. Before we start, though, can you perhaps give us your reflections on the food tech investment world in 2020?
Yeah, thanks, Stefan. I think we can all agree that 2020 was a challenging year for all of us in many aspects. I think the agri-food sector is no different. What I would say is that the sector came under a significant spotlight, mostly due to the national lockdowns. And that was really, for me, it was highlighting the need for a robust supply chain. I think we could see that through the panic buying that occurred in most of the countries. It definitely happened here in the UK. And a robust agri-food supply chain was definitely highlighted. The other thing that happened is the focus on climate and what the lockdowns, what impact the lockdowns had on pollution and the climate change and the agri-food sector was contributing towards both of those. So I think there's a lot highlighted around both of those, and they're obviously very interlinked. We've also seen a lot of interesting new fund launches focusing on both the agri-food and linked to climate, and looking at more sustainable food production. I would say that, you know, there's a lot of capital out there now. They're ready to deploy. They're interested in looking for new technologies. I think this would have happened without the pandemic, but I think and 2020 has really highlighted the need for new innovations, greater investment into sustainability in the agri-food sector, and a real focus on how that investment supports positive support of the environment and climate change.
And Paul, would you say that that focus changed, investment focus changed, or had it already changed anyway?
Yeah, look, I think the agri-food sector, or the investment in the agri-food sector, has been changing over the last decade. We've seen a significant increase in investment into the sector. There's been about $25 billion invested into the sector over the last decade. The last 3 years has seen a majority of that, and that's probably been spread by somewhere between 100 to 200 of those companies. You know, I think it changed. It probably accelerated in some respects because of 2020 and what's happened in 2020. But I think the change was happening anyway. I think we could see how the sector has evolved, and I would say probably matured. We'd seen a significant amount of investment and capital going towards the meal kit delivery in the e-commerce space. And I think it's fair to say that that part of the sector is probably the lowest barrier to entry, and efficiencies through digital innovation were relatively straightforward. What we're now seeing is that the increased investments are going into more capital intensive innovation, the alternative proteins, the consumer health, processing hardware inputs, and I guess the other thing we're seeing is an increase in ticket sizes. So the amount of capital deployed into each of these technologies. And that really just goes to show that the sector is maturing. That obviously leaves a gap in the early stage investing pace, but I think this has happened in other sectors. This has happened in other technologies, and I think the agri-food sector is maturing. And I think 2020 probably sped that up, but it was heading that way anyway.
And Roger, was this your experience as well within your community of investors? Did you see that that COVID-19 slowed down investment, or that in some areas it actually sped it up or increased the investment that was made?
Well, I definitely agree with the general sense. We with our fund are actually investing in this early to grow stage in the ag food or the ag tech food sector. So indeed, there we do feel that there's still, in general, although the market is maturing, there's a scarcity of funding. What we have seen in the market drivers, it's basically consumer demand and regulatory pressure, right? We do see a growing push by consumers for whether it's better health or their wellness, traceability, indeed also alternative proteins, but also we see like the dynamic of an increasing regulatory pressure with the Green Deal coming up. And that resulted from our end, actually in a spur of actually investors investing in our fund. So we see from an LP perspective that definitely has been accelerated by COVID. On a portfolio company level, let's say the real innovation and disruptors that we are supporting, they have been... I would say predominantly struggling with the lockdowns because they couldn't visit the farms in practice. And where farmers, they tend to appreciate face-to-face contact, and actually if there's innovation and disruption to be implemented, they want to see it, they want to test it, they want to pilot it. And because the season is quite, or the business is quite seasonal, and if you miss a season, basically, your pivot or your beta version cannot be implemented directly. We have seen a delay in growth of revenues. However, we also have seen that a lot of portfolio companies companies in this space have been having continuous support of their existing shareholder base. So I do believe there's great trust that the market is heading into this direction of more sustainable practices, and that support both the portfolio companies by a continuous support of their existing shareholder base. And on the other hand, we do see that investors in general see that the market tendency is going into the into this industry, because the dynamics are pretty clear, right? There's a continuous need for a more sustainable practices. The consumers are asking for it. There's more political pull. It's a market which is still relatively, technologically, it's quite low with regard to digital penetration. So also it's a great investment opportunity. And the other thing is that a lot of those innovation in the end has for investors pretty good exit potential, because they're quite big, oligopolistic almost, or monopolistic structures in play for big players in the end just buy out R&D. So also that makes investors quite keen.
Yeah. Now, Paul, have you seen the same? So Roger's talking about the lack of access to farms. And I wonder, does this also spread to a sort of a slowing down of clinical trial work? If you don't get research data to back up an investment opportunity, does that mean that it's been difficult to commit to investments?
I'd probably say here that I've been lucky enough during lockdown to spend most of lockdowns one and two, and now three, on our own family farm. We have a farm in the east of England. It's been in the family for about 900 years, and it's an in-hand mixed arable farm, and sitting in the middle of the farm and being involved in the farming community over the last sort of decade or so here in the UK. Farmers are resilient, and I think that's probably one of the big takeaways from the farming and food sector over 2020 is the level of resilience. And I also say that, you know, it's almost like it's been business as usual. You know, they've been hard at work. They've been doing what they've always been doing. I think one thing that contributed towards the probably one of the biggest challenges was the fruit and veg, which relied on a seasonal workforce, and that resulted in labor shortages, and some of them, you know, there was a lot of innovative ideas around mobilizing a national labor force to help with that, or flying in people from overseas to come and help. But I think farmers have a pretty resilient bunch, and they've been continuing to do what they've always done and innovate and take risks and do what they're doing on the farm. I think one thing I definitely agree with Roger is that, you know, the regulatory pressures at the moment and the changes, you know, we see with the Ag Bill in the UK, the Green Deal in Europe, Brexit, there are a lot of things happening, a lot of uncertainty, especially around subsidy payments. And farmers are having to sort of navigate that. And I think adding the requirement of adopting innovation and field trials is probably a step too far for some of them over the last year or even potentially the next year because of all these changes and additional risks that are being layered on. So I think that is one of the biggest risks for innovators is being able to prove that their technology it can be adapted and can be scaled. And field trials obviously goes into that. So yeah, I think it is a challenge. I think adoption in this sector has always been a challenge and will continue to be a challenge, but field trials is a necessity. And I think investors, as I said earlier, the sector is maturing. And as the sector matures, investors are deploying larger amounts of capital. They want to see that the technology works. They want to see that it is being adopted and is being scaled. And the only way to do that is to see it being deployed by the food producers themselves.
Yeah, and that's what's been slowing down. Okay, now before we dive into what we're looking at for 2021, Roger, can you just explain to us the concept of impact investment? I presume this goes hand in hand with your company being a B Corporation, but can you tell us what it means? What are the principles behind it?
Yeah, of course, and thanks for the question. It's also driven by COVID, something which became more apparent for a lot of people that investing is not only about making profit. Pandemic established in 1994 was the first venture fund who was investing according to 3 P's: people, planet, profit. But in the recent years, that has become something which has become known as impact investing. And I mean, the principle is actually fairly simple. It is the principle that you invest actually not only for financial profit, but also with a positive impact. And there, the linkage towards the food systems are pretty clear. Simply because if you look at all the SDGs which are out there, the food system, it's such a positive, but it's so interconnected. It basically, whether you talk about zero hunger or no poverty or life on land, climate action, it all somehow evolves in the food system in a way that if we can assure that we actually bring innovation and disruption in such a way that we, on the one hand, ensure that we actually can feed the growing amount of mouth in the upcoming years, on the other hand, reduce the pressure on both human and also natural resources. But on top of that, and that's often forgotten, that we actually also support innovation and disruption, which actually supports the farmers. Because what is the trend which has been ongoing actually since the Green Revolution in the 70s, that the market and the yields have been increasing significantly, but also the market dynamics for farmers never actually really improved. They actually deteriorated, where they have to work harder, they have to work harder with less. And in the end, bottom line, they don't really have an influence on the pricing in general, which leaves them basically, keep working very hard, but bottom line, indeed, struggle to have a general good livelihood. So what we try to do with impact investing, especially for those companies where which are growing and which are scaling, well, more investors come in. And when more investors come in, often money starts talking more and more. So we can play like what we call like the impact guardian role. So we ensure with the leadership team that like the positive mission that often those innovators also have, and whether it's chemical reduction or whether it's in creating a technology which provides farmers with a better transparent supply chain, or well, one way or the other, we ensure that such a mission actually gets embedded into the governance of a company, and we structure with the leadership team and also with the other shareholders, though, like clear impact KPIs, which allows us to also on the board level to actually have a debate about impact. And if you, for example, take a company which reformulates pesticides or herbicides and thereby reducing chemical load, and they have a product A and a product B, both have the same market potential, but product A has a higher positive impact because it reduces the chemical load significantly more than product B, then the impact theory basically gives them a basis to actually choose for that product and then actually align impact with operations. So that's it's absolutely not philanthropy. I mean, we all our IPs, LPs also expect, a solid financial return. But it's just ensuring that every investment that you do, brings also a positive impact. So it's, a lot of funds relate to ESG. This is, I would say, one step further down the road, right? It's really diving into the company, into the governance to ensure that the impact is embedded. But it has the same principle, investing with a positive outcome.
Yeah. Now, I wonder, Paul, I know that we shouldn't be talking in generalized concepts here, but I'm really interested. Is this concept a natural evolution of capitalism, or is it a sort of self-interested, concept that is natural, or is this sort of anti-capitalistic?
You're referring to impact investing generally?
Yeah, well, people, planet, profit. You know, the concept that that profit isn't the main driver, that there are other things that are important. Does this go against sort of capitalist principles?
I think there's a lot of ways to answer that. I think it really depends on the investment. Let me start by saying I think this is going to be mainstream. I think in the future, I think impact investing or investing for a purpose or people planet. What was the other one? Sorry,
people planet. Profit.
Profit. People planet profit. Exactly. I think it's going to be part of the DNA for investors in the future. I think generally it's going to be a requirement. And I think that's driven in part, you could see it with what's happening in the agri-food sector, the consumer pressure. And the thematic change is that the next generation, the generation after that, are asking for more transparency. They're asking for more accountability. And I think, look at the family offices, the transition and succession planning from one generation to the next. The next generation are going to change their deployment of capital from just being about profit to being more around impact. But I'm going to caveat that with one thing, and that is that the whole definition of impact is quite fuzzy. It really it's going to depend on each individual's view of what impact actually means. And it's interesting, ESG is a metric. It's, are you talking about listed investors ESG versus a venture capitalist ESG versus a societal benefiting society as a sort of a metric for impact? And each investor, their definition of impact, which runs within their mission and their KPIs, is going to be very, very different. And I've seen this firsthand on many panels where you see impact investors argue about what they think is impactful and what's not. And I use the example, you could think building a school is impactful, or investing in a farm is impactful, but if you have no students in that school, there's no impact. So I think it really comes back to, you know, measurement of that impact. And I think there's lots of companies, B Corp, a good example of a company that's set out to try and provide a framework in which we can measure not only the impact, but as being an impactful company, but also what's the outcome of that? And you can see that in farming. You know, on a daily basis, I'm talking about how can we support farming to move to a more sustainable, regenerative farming method. We have to pay for an outcome-based model. The expectation that subsidies and payments are going to be there for just supporting food production is not good enough, and it won't be good enough in the future. You need to mm-hmm. grow more with less. There needs to be an outcome base. I think that's the same with that impact investing.
And with that, Paul, you've brilliantly brought us out of a hypothetical wormhole that I dug us down into. So well done.
My pleasure.
Right, okay, let's talk specifics really about 2021. Roger, what do you think are going to be the biggest areas of interest for food tech investors in the coming year?
If you look at the food system in general, you have so many areas where investors are could play an interesting role. We normally refer to the transformative 12 technologies, which are also being mentioned by the World Economic Forum, right? It's a wave of transformation which already is taking place to improve the agricultural production efficiencies. Also, transparency will play a role. Supply chain. It's for us, like, we see that precision farming is had a combination of hardware and AI machine learning is an area of great interest, simply because also we have the access to the farms, and we do believe that there's definitely a big ground to win. Alternative proteins is one thing. Local production, like vertical farming, definitely an interesting area as well. However, both alternative proteins and vertical farming quite capital intensive. It's somehow changing the shape of the demand for food. It's promoting somehow value chain linkages and in the end also creating a more effective production system. These are the three areas when you talk about the transformative 12, where our core focus right now is with regard to precision agriculture to somehow reduce the input and improve the water use optimization. That's where we actually see quite an interesting market. Also because the capital intensity in that specific sector is a bit less if you compare, for example, towards alternative proteins or vertical farming.
Yes, yeah. And Paul, I mean, you're coming from this from as well as the investment perspective. You are a farmer as well. So, what do you see as being the most important areas of interest for 2021?
Yeah, I think Roger hit the nail on the head in terms of precision farming. I mean, precision farming is going to be crucial. And precision farming, I think, you know, if we were trying to define it, it's about growing more with less and growing more with less sustainably or with less impact on the environment. I think that's, and the technologies that are going to support that are crucial. Look, from a farmer's perspective, you know, there's, without subsidies, a lot of farmers are not going to be able to make a profit. So, you know, being able to be profitable is crucial. And let's also caveat by saying, you know, we're talking about developed markets versus developing markets. And I think, you know, it's what the technologies that are going to work in places like Asia, Africa, and are going to be significantly different to the ones that we see in a more developed markets in North America and Europe and the UK. So I'm focusing predominantly on developed markets because in developing markets it's a very different answer. But so I think precision ag and the technologies that are going to support precision ag are definitely going to be crucial.
Can you give us an example of something? Are we talking apps? Are we talking?
So I think farmers, from a farmer's perspective, farmers want to grow more with less. They want to increase profit. So there's a lot of variability when it comes to farming. Commodity, as Roger touched on earlier, you know, commodity prices, weather, regulatory changes, policy changes, all these things the farmer has to worry about, environmental restrictions, All these things farmers have to worry about on a day-to-day basis. So I think technologies and innovations that are going to reduce that risk are going to play a crucial part in allowing farmers and fruit producers the breathing space to adopt more innovation. And by being comfortable with the risk, reducing it and adopting more innovation, you see other technologies become adopted. And so I personally think the focus should be on the enablers that reduce that risk and provide the safety blanket. And I think precision ag is definitely going to be a part of that. But I think also fintech and other technologies you're seeing in other sectors that can be applied to the agriculture and agri-food sector are going to be crucial. Those that are providing insurance, those that are providing better terms of finance or supporting outcome-based farming or supporting greater adoption of innovation. If I was to call out one, you know, a great innovation that's happening over in the States, it's a company called Farmers Edge. You know, they're providing financing for farmers that are adopting innovation. That's a great example of an enabler that I think we need to come up with more innovation that is frictionless to farmers and not requiring a behavioral change that allows them to de-risk as much as possible to ride this very, very chaotic and volatile wave that we're going to see over the next couple of years.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, Roger, in terms of finding the next project to invest in, I think it was mentioned earlier on that there's a scarcity of funding, but does that mean that this goes in tandem with a lack of investment opportunities? Are you out there trying to find projects? Do people come to you, or is it a balance of the two? What seems to work best?
Well, I think what works best is a combination. What we do feel is that building the relationship for a longer term with an entrepreneur is the best way to, in the end, also join as a shareholder or an investor. In the end, it is a bit like stepping together into a marriage, right? They're all in still early to grow stage. I mean, we are investing in Series A, Series B.
And who's flirting most with the other?
Yeah, well, it really depends as well, right? I have to say that the later stage a company is, the more effort you as an investor need to put forward to actually join a certain consortium. And it's also by making yourself as an investor explicit of what your added value would be for them having you in the consortium. From our end, it's yes, it's on the one hand network. On the other hand, it's definitely the impact guardian role that we play. Like we are more and more invited by entrepreneurs in bigger consortia where our ticket is even not that big, so bigger rounds, but our ticket itself is not that big. But we can support them in that specific area. Answering your question, deal sourcing, especially when we start with this, supporting of the food system in 3.5 years ago, it was more difficult to find the right opportunity because also entrepreneurs don't know that you're out there. In Europe in general, there's not a lot of investors purely focusing on the food systems. So that definitely helps if you narrow down your focus on a specific theme and even within the food system. For example, right now where we are quite strong in precision farming, it helps because the precision farming entrepreneurs talk to each other as well when they're up for a new funding round. So it's network, like the deals that we have done so far, like the current fund has a portfolio of eight to nine portfolio companies, and most of them actually came through a longer lasting relationship that we have been building up, maybe even over a year with entrepreneurs, right? You start talking, you start having a coffee, you start discussing what you can add and what they are looking for. And then in the end, when a new funding round comes up, you join and other investment partners as well. So if you If you are having a portfolio company and you're opening up for a next round, you're, as an investor, as an existing shareholder, quite keen to work with other investors that you know. So also that relationship towards other co-shareholders is something which is quite important to get new deals in.
So the blend itself is vital as well.
Yeah.
I'd love to jump in and just very quickly add something on that, if I may. And that is, I think I completely agree with a lot of those points. And I've had the opportunity to launch two venture funds previously that were in the seed to Series A, more on the digital, not related to agriculture. And I was given the opportunity to be involved with Shake Climate Change, which is a very, very early stage pre-product investment vehicle that is backed by philanthropic capital. And what really excited me about that was the fact that, as Roger pointed out, that, you know, a number of years ago, there was very, very little deal flow. And as we see the market maturing and these much larger investors, there are some funds that have launched with £200-300 million that are very excited about deploying millions of pounds, dollars, euros into new technologies, but there's not enough technologies that are getting through the pipeline. And I think there is this gap and a widening gap, and there needs to be more investors in the earlier stage to work very closely with these entrepreneurs and the technologies, predominantly which, if I look at the number of applications we get with Shake, there's another one called Rockstart that is specifically focused on agri-food. I know you've had the Yield Lab on the show before. And Thrive Agritech is another one. There are some that are scattered around the world, but we need more of the early stage space. And most of the companies that I see and the founders that I see are coming out of universities. They need a lot of support. They need a little bit of capital. And they need to be given the opportunity to grow and set the KPIs to get ready for these late stage investors. Because I see there's a lot of capital at the late stage, but there's not enough capital, not enough support at the early stage. So the likes of the Yield Lab and Shake and Thrive play a part in developing this ecosystem. But I think all of us need to really support building that ecosystem out more, because I just don't think we're seeing enough deal flow. We're not supporting enough early stage pre-product innovations. And I think in the agri-food sector, especially in these capital intensive, whether it be vertical farming, robotics, alternative proteins, they need a lot of capital, they need a lot of help, and they need a long runway. And we need to all support that.
Hmm. Let's talk a little bit about alternative proteins. Roger, now, the whole world of alternative protein has been in enormous growth for the last few years. And COVID-19 has put a sharper focus on the roles that animals play in spreading human pathogens. Now, this is now a relatively mature area, isn't it? Are alternative proteins still an attractive investment opportunity? Is the growth still there?
Well, I think that alternative proteins overall are also being supported by the trend towards more plant-based diets. I personally believe that. I'm quite intrigued by that industry in general, and we have seen so many different opportunities for it. But we had two main problems with it. One is how do you determine the winner? That was one big problem, and the other big problem was that it's so capital intensive to really scale. Does that mean
you're always a minority investor, do you think?
Yeah, well, yes, and also our fund size, although we are currently raising our second fund of around 60 to 70 million, is still relatively small for these type of plays. So being a minority shareholder is not a problem per se, but the combination then between, how do you know what is the winner? And how do you determine that? And on the top of that, the capital intensity, and then also the fact that you will be dependent on consumer demand as well, and how that will develop. I'm pretty sure it will grow. How fast it will grow, we have to see. But I do believe that it's a crucial it's a crucial component in the whole transitioning of the food system. There needs to be a change in diets, not only towards plant-based diets, but in general, just a more healthy diet. If you talk about the obesity of people, which is a big problem in the developed world.
And so that's where the opportunity still lies, I guess. Now, so Paul, what about in vitro meat? I mean, it's still yet to reach scale. We're talking about huge cost of entry. Is it still an area of interest to you?
Goodness. I've tried a few of them and they're fine. I think there's, as Roger said, there's a huge amount of capital that needs to be deployed to make these things work. I think this is there's a lot of interesting innovation coming out of the States. We've seen a number of applicants from UK universities through Shake. I've seen some interesting opportunities in Israel, and there's lots going out there. I think for me, it's not a winner take all. I think it's going to be like there's an increased consumer appetite for plant based foods and meat alternatives generally. And I think that's going to continue to grow. And I think just like we see today in a typical meat aisle or in the supermarket, there's going to be different products branded in different ways. And I think as the market matures, you can just see changes in branding and change. You already see this with the milk alternative markets. You know, I whether it's oats or almond milk or soy or this. It wasn't just a case of soy milk taking over the entire alternative milk market. You've suddenly got Oatly and now you've got, what's another one? I mean, there's so many now. I think we're just going to see the same thing happen. Look, I think that there are investors out there that are willing to take the risk and willing to have deep pockets to be able to support the innovation purely from an agri-tech perspective. I think there's so many other things we can and should be investing in that will generate significantly better sustainable return metrics and reduce carbon output than alternative meats. But that's my personal opinion. I think there's more we can do to help the farmer and the food supply chain as it is today, rather than coming up with new products. Not to say it won't happen in the future. I just think that there's challenges that exist today that need investment and need focus.
Yeah, I mean, why am I asking a farmer that question in the first place? Okay, now, Roger, so in terms of sustainability and climate change perspective, what is exciting for investors looking ahead to 2021? I mean, are you looking at changing regulation and that possibly warping markets in ways that can be opportunities as well as threats? So with coming regulations, certainly in the UK, we've got new regulations about agriculture. We've got looming changes with climate change targets and CO2 emissions targets. Will this play into the hands of certain technologies and make them more of an investment opportunity?
I think it will be an enormous push. For example, technologies we invested in two technologies which significantly reduce the amount of pesticides being used or sprayed on the farms. And by doing so, also directly create reports for the farmers, which they can use to comply with the regulatory pressure, which is indeed increasing because of the Green Deal. I personally see that is something which can help the farmers actually make the decision to implement certain technologies. Still, it all has to do also with pricing, and in the end, new technologies, they need to have a short-term return on investment for the farmers as well. But I feel that, well, let's take the Green Deal as an example, which clearly states 50% of chemical reduction, right, or pesticide and fertilizer reduction. Technologies like TrapView, technologies like Augmenta, all scale-up companies out there which create solutions for the farmers to do more precision spraying. So not just go out there and spray preventively, but actually spray only areas where it's needed. I think that will have, definitely a tremendous push. And that will differ per country as well. I know in France, they're even stricter on it. But yes, so for our investment portfolio specifically, I definitely believe that the regulatory pressure will help those scale-ups to accelerate faster away from remaining like a startup. So my answer is definitely yes.
Yeah. So Roger, you're coming back to precision agriculture again as well. Now, Paul, is precision agriculture, again, I'm asking a farmer this question, I guess, but is this the low-hanging fruit? Is this the area which is easiest to tackle first to make the greatest change?
Yeah, I think I think precision ag is, again, it's a bit like impact investing. Precision ag to different people means different things. Ultimately, it's all about reducing inputs and increasing outputs. So the technology, I think that's the same with ag tech to one person might be drones and robots. Another might be CRISPR and genetic modifications. So I think precision ag, or the whole point of growing more with less is definitely should be the focus. It's what technologies are going to try and enable that is the interesting thing. And reducing inputs by looking at biofertilizers or different ways to enhance crop yield through the use of less chemicals, I think is definitely a need for that. So all of these big statements that the large agri-food businesses are saying, the large businesses are saying about reducing their carbon output and their carbon impact, carbon footprint, they're very grand statements. And obviously the regulatory changes are going to try and enforce this. I think the biggest challenge at the moment for most of these businesses, they have a massive supply chain. They have a very complex supply chain. And if you ask the head of sustainability of one of these big companies, what does their supply chain look like? What is their carbon footprint? Where is it coming from? Most of it, they would say, is coming from their suppliers because they can't get transparency or traceability on their supply chain. So they're making these big statements and having to act on it and try and meet these targets. But until we can get to the point where you know what's happening on every single field, it's going to be almost impossible to be able to meet these targets if you can't verify it. So I think, technologies that are supporting that, that get down to what's happening at field level, it's a massive challenge. You can only do so much with satellites and drones. You need sensors, you need access to private data. Then you're talking about, GDPR. You're talking about engaging with farmers and knowing intimately what their farming practices is, and then proving that you're not going to do anything with that data. So I think technologies that are able to access that data and utilize that data in a very sensitive way, and with your blockchain is one of them. Blockchain, I think, in the agriculture and food supply chain is going to has the opportunity to change many markets and many commodity plays. And I'll call one out, because there's one I've been working with on the Yara side. It's based in Switzerland. It's called PharmaConnect, and they're using blockchain technology to provide traceability along the coffee supply chain. Early stage startup that was basically a corporate spin out, launched on the back of a real challenge that traders and retailers and those others in the food supply chain required traceability. They needed to prove and verify that they had a sustainable and verified traceable supply chain. And without technologies like blockchain or without remote sensing, it's going to be very, very difficult.
Yeah, to add to that, if I may, Stefan, like two trends, which indeed, but maybe a bit more in the long run. We have mentioned robotics. Paul also mentioned the lack of labor force because of COVID. So the aim to get more autonomous machines in the field is definitely something which would help farmers a lot. It's not only replacing labor force, but it's also a reduction of soil compaction, which is a big problem, especially in Europe. So robotics can solve that, but before you actually get to a full autonomous vehicle, like also quite some regulatory matters needs to be sorted. But like a French-based company called NIO is pretty far ahead with that. And last but not least, also food safety in general. So procedures about where does the food, procedures and technology, and whether that's software or more, let's say, business practices. But how can you create a better safety procedures for food processors and create more transparency of ingredients and potential pathogens out there? Because health is extremely important in these days.
And has become more of a focus for the consumer. Yeah,
if I could just give one UK example, and you know, you can see this with vertically integrated supply chains, but not everyone has the opportunity to do this. And you can look at what Dyson has done on his own farm in beeswax. You know, they're very much around sustainability and provenance. And they've created a system that which allows them to know exactly where every grain, every strawberry, everything that's harvested and farmed, where it's come from, what's happened to that field, where it's going. And I think there's a value in the food security and food safety and provenance. Dyson obviously has a significant amount of resources and farmland, and they could do that. But I think it's being able to democratize the same systems and the same technology to farmers, whether you're a 1 acre farmer or a 40,000 acre farmer. You will be required to provide that level of traceability and have it independently verified. So I think technologies that support that are going to be crucial.
Yeah. Okay. Well, last couple of questions for you. First of all, what is exciting and possibly unknown to the general consumer about developments for the year ahead? Are there a few, is there something on the horizon that particularly interests you that you think maybe we don't really know about yet? Roger, anything that springs to mind for you?
Yeah, there's so many things to say now. Like I think the exciting part is just the consumer awareness that things need to change. We see such a spur for startups because of COVID, and whether it's shortening the supply chain, reducing food loss, farm digitization, or a change in plant-based diets. If you just talk to people in general, now people are more aware of what food supply chains are and why it's important that like you also support more local production versus like this global scale. So I think the exciting bit is the food systems. Well, it's a bit weird, but like COVID gave also the opportunity to put it more on under the, well, how do you say it? The headlights, or let's say the spotlights, I have to say. And that creates a dynamic for both investors, consumers, and also, regulatory bodies to really have a push. And in that sense, also the fact that, and you see even certain documentaries, right? If you talk about the documentary Kiss the Ground, people are becoming more aware that soil is crucial. And we can't continue on the route that we are by just depleting our resources. And yeah, I feel that in this whole equation, we shouldn't forget the farmers. That is the most important bit, because they need to do the hard work. But so overall, answering your question, the excitement for me is that this is an area which just is getting more and more traction in general consumer awareness and awareness in general.
Mm. And Paul, anything in particular that excites you about opportunities in the year ahead?
Yeah, I think I'll also say something similar in terms of, I think Roger said the, you know, consumer interest and the level of interest in the sector and improving the sector is definitely increasing. And I think you could see that from the consumer side, but you can also see it from the innovator side. And I don't think there's been any other time that I've seen more people that are wanting to start businesses or create innovations or look at new ways of doing things. whether it be the next generation of farmers or those that have exited from businesses that are looking at developing something that is going to have some lasting impact, that are trying to look at better ways to feed the world with less impact on the environment. I think that for me is really exciting. I think the drive towards a sustainable food production system is happening. And I think things like, if I was to look ahead at, 2021, things like a greater use of data to support insights for farmers. There's a number of technologies I've seen that are doing that. There's a number of technologies that are, again, as I said, reducing risk by providing capital to innovators and farmers to support greater adoption. There are technologies coming out of universities that are again growing more with less, biostimulants that can potentially increase yield by 100-200% just through natural synthesis of existing systems without the use of chemicals. But these are technologies that I think the farmer doesn't have to change their process, their practice, their behavior, and yet they're either seeing a significant increase to yield or reducing costs to be able to adopt. And I think on the consumer side, the opportunity to have more traceability and transparency, to know where your food has come from, to know the level of impact that product has on the environment through a carbon footprint, I think is, and having the capital to support those innovations, I think we're going to see more of that in the next year or so.
Brilliant. Okay. Now, one very, very short question, and I'm after a very short answer here. I've got £10 million to give each of you. What would you invest in? And I'm looking for either a sector of the agritech or an individual company. So, Roger, £10 million, where's it going to go?
I would say I would invest it in indeed data-driven solutions for farmers. So an example is a French-based company called Augmenta. They basically provide a field analyzer, so remote sensing, or not a remote sensing, a sensor helping them with instant decisions and precision spraying. So back to the precision spraying and the precision farming.
Very good. Okay, and Paul, where would your $10 million go?
I think I would split it. I think I'd probably put it. One is to again reduce the risk. So support technologies that can verify an outcome-based farming model that is sustainable and environmentally friendly. I think in support of that, I think there's others out there that are using green bonds and carbon credits to pay farmers to against a specific framework to move to more sustainable farming practices. And I think that's a very smart way of deploying capital, because you see at the end of the day, you see a farm that has given the opportunity to transition and is therefore going to be in a much better place to be profitable on its own in the future.
Hmm. That was $5 million. Where's the other five going?
We're at five and five. One's a technology, one's a bond.
Excellent. Well, Roger and Paul, thank you so much for joining us today. It has been absolutely fascinating. You've been listening to the Tabletop Podcast brought to you by Food Matters, and you heard from Paul Rouse and Roger Peterson, and me, Stefan Gates. Thank you very much to both of you. Now, if you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts in our investment series, hearing from a myriad of investors, startups, and disruptors shaping the future of our food system. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatters.co.uk. Gentlemen, thank you so much. You've been listening to the Tabletop Podcast, brought to you by Food Matters. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, please visit foodmatters.co.uk.